Good evening. Very good to be back. Missed you guys. Thought of you on Tuesday night. It was between shows or between gigs or something. We drove down from Arcata on Tuesday evening and then started it all up again on Wednesday morning. So, fortunately, Willits was a little different. It was just sitting 3 hours in the morning. So it wasn't nearly as intense as the Arcata one where we were sitting all day long. But they both went very well. Really quite remarkably well. In Arcata, people are just beginning to get the sense of what it is and wanting to make longer sits and coming out of the sits with a different feeling about what they're doing. So it's very satisfying to be in a situation like that. It's like being inside of a flower or something, and it just keeps opening petals and blooming.
Is it the same people?
Yes, pretty much the same people. Now and then there's some new one who slips in. This time there was the kind of one who'd always been on the edges and who's always been kind of critical, but kind of curious too, and so she'd be on the edges. And somehow this time she heard something different, and she stayed. And she stayed almost the whole time and came out of it beaming. Said, "Oh, now I understand what we're doing. I get it." And that's so satisfying. It makes, you know, driving 300 miles really worth it. How is it with Michael? You gave him a hard time?
We
tried.
We actually talked about art.
Oh, nice.
Great, I'm just kidding.
Ah, that is perfect. That's what he is.
But he kept backing out of it. We, you know, cornered him and he'd, no, you know. We'd ask him more. But I didn't know that he was an artist.
Oh, yes.
With Bodhi, Princeton,
yes,
I didn't know that.
Bodhidharma has reproductions of some of his work, several of them, I think. Yeah.
Yes, he ended it by stating, you know, not to worry about creating, just concern ourselves with the Bodhisattva way.
So we brought it all the way back down to here. Well, that was good. That was perfect. Yeah.
You talked about that striving to create art seems to be itself a form of attachment.
Absolutely. That's torture. That's real suffering. Huh, that's wonderful. Well, we're on chapter two, or I guess they're chapters. What is it called? We've taking hold of bodhicitta. Is that what it is? No. Confession. Preparing the ground for the mind of bodhicitta is what I think Pema calls it and thank you. So apparently this is traditional, the way he does it. And I know a little bit because I participated in a ceremony that my friend Tinley did years ago in India at her father's temple. Her father died when she was quite young, and a very old monk became her substitute father. Very sweet old guy, Gegenla. And Gegenla was, by the time we got there, really old and obviously didn't have very much longer to live. And so Tinley decided to do a long life ceremony for him. And it was very much like this, a kind of offering of many things. And they were conventional. There was a convention about it. Flowers, of course, and food, water in special containers, things made out of butter carved in different figures, very elaborate figures. I can't remember how it went exactly anymore, but it was very much like this, the confession and the purification of oneself. Many prostrations. And then taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha over and over again. And then coming back and acknowledging oneself and one's way in the world in all of its messiness, you could say. And then going back to opening up to the whole situation. I think it was a kind of emptying of the self, and that it took all afternoon to get all the way down to the no-self part, where it was just everyone doing the whole thing. I think that's what Shantideva is doing in this chapter called Confession. He's making many offerings, wonderful offerings. I think it's enchanting, all the things he's offering. Every kind of healing draught, mountains of precious jewels, fragrance, divine fragrance. It just goes on and on. He offers his body. He offers a bathing chamber, a fragrant bathing chamber. That's wonderful. Pillars shimmering with gems. It's like he was just racking his brains to think of every possible thing that he could offer in the world, including his whole self. He goes on to talk about himself. In this and all my other lives, while turning in the round without beginning, blindly I have brought forth evil and incited others to commit the same. Deceived and overmastered by my ignorance, I have taken pleasure in such sin. And seeing now the blame of it, I confess it earnestly. This is not the kind of sin that we grew up with. This is not the kind of sin that, when we die, will send us straight to the fiery depths of hell, never to come back, and to suffer for eternity. That is such an alarming idea. there is a hell realm in Buddhism, but in the hell realm accepts anyone who has truly messed up. But there is always the possibility of being reborn out of the hell realm. In fact, it's inevitable. And the heavenly realms, it's not a fixed place either. You can end up in the heavenly realms where everything is just perfect and there's no problems at all. But it's a form of suffering also. And it also, those are subject to rebirth. So there's no end to the round of it, from the hell realm to the hungry ghost to the animal realm to the fighting realm to the human realm to the heavenly realm. We talk about the six worlds. Those are the six worlds. And we cycle through all of them. And what they say in Buddhism is that the human realm is the only realm where we can slow down enough and be awake and aware enough to see what the condition is and step off or step out. Not be driven by this continual round. You can look at it in simply in psychological terms, which is mostly what I do, that if I'm in a really miserable place in my mind, it feels sometimes like a hell realm. Sometimes it feels like an animal realm where I just don't care, or a fighting anger, you know, fierce, warlike realm, or sometimes the heavenly realm where everything just is so nice. It never lasts. None of it lasts. And of course, we want the good ones to last and we want to get out of the bad ones. So the advice in our practice is to practice hard as a human being, that we try our best to exercise our humanity. And as they describe bodhicitta, we put our best effort into turning our attention and our intention toward the useful and the wholesome, that we actually choose instead of just being kind of driven by what's happening, that we over and over make the choice to step forward and to help things move forward as they can. So Shantideva is accepting the, which is what we do when we take the precepts, accepting the fact that as human beings, we have all these worlds in us, and that we've made a lot of mistakes, and we need to know that and acknowledge that in order to go on. If we float on the surface of the world pretending that we're really, really good, it doesn't serve us or anybody else. It's much better to be as honest as we can. And it's straightforward. Admit our mistakes, take the blame, and just go on. It saves a heck of a lot of trouble. So then he goes into... into the shocking realization that he's going to die, and that everybody's going to die, all his friends and foes. So all this trouble that he's taken for everything is really for naught, and nobody can die for him, nobody can be there with him, he's just going to have to die all by himself. That's a realization that comes to each of us at one point or another. I met a woman in Willits whose partner died in November, and she said, she referred to it as the time when I woke up. She said before that she just didn't quite understand, but when her partner died she woke up and started to practice, and already had a good deal of insight into practice itself. Still very sad, but with a kind of, her partner said before she died, she said, you'll find out that there's a gift inside the grief. And she said, yeah, it's true. It's true. There is a gift in here. Very touching. So he goes on quite a lot about getting sick and dying. And he's hoping that he can find some fearlessness. Says, fearing all the pains to come, I join my palms and ceaselessly prostrate, and everything I will confess directly in the sight of my protectors. And then he prays for guidance. Take me as I am. And all these actions, whatever they are, I promise I will try not to do anymore. Well, you know, it's really hard to say in Buddhism, because there is prayer, and yet there isn't a God. So it's a kind of, I think it's, you could say to your higher self, if you, you know, something like that. I mean, it's like offering oneself to the whole dynamic life of everything, and being willing to let things be as they are. It's what allows the whole thing to flow rather than being blocked. And it also allows us much more insight. The more surrendered we are to an accepting of the way things are, the more we begin to, you can't really say understand, but feel our way in much more clarity. It doesn't mean things will go better. In some ways, it just gets harder and harder. The Bodhisattva way is a hard way. But it means that with a kind of clarity of intention, we're able to meet with, I don't know, Bodhisattva energy, Jōriki energy. To be, well, I don't know what the word is. Proactive, I guess, is what I mean. You know, out there rather than back here. Not withholding anything. So I think that's all I have in my notes, except for the notion of emptying the self, which I've been reading a lot in the last few days, Someone said that the wound of existence is our sense of separation. And bodhicitta itself is an insight into how there is no separation. And a beginning of the healing of the wound. I like that image. And that we have habits of excluding ourselves from things. We develop all these careful habits. I'll go there, but I won't go there. I'll do this, but I won't do that. In Zen, they talk about choiceless choice sometimes. Someone asked me about what I do and asked how I chose to do this. And I started to answer and realized I didn't have an answer. I realized I really didn't choose it at all. It's just what happened. And I think the more our life can be like that, the more rich and fulfilled and useful it can be to go. That's what Joseph Campbell said, go where the bliss is, where fulfillment is. It sounds selfish, but it's the opposite, actually. It's the dissolving of that sense of separation. It's really diving in. So, are there questions, Dan?
I'm quite sure I've asked this question before, because I know I've been in a mindset where it came up when I was working still. But I'll reiterate it, because I think I'm in a different mindset, and I think the answer changes also for me and for everybody else. How does one know whether, when things aren't going your way, well, to your liking, whatever, how does one know in that state whether you have resentment towards a reluctant acceptance, like a grudging fatality to the situation, versus, I think, what Shantideva and you are speaking of, which comes through a realization of the dynamics of the situation. It's part of a larger thing. There's a flow, and it isn't so much I'm mad at it. It isn't a fatalistic I have to take it kind of attitude.
Yes,
there is some other way of going about it, and I literally can't explain it. I think one can taste it through practice, and there's this some other kind of being with it that's not as choice-oriented. It seems to be more neutral, and that word's come up in many of the questions I've asked before.
Mm-hmm.
But my question tonight is, how do we know whether we're veering towards that reluctant acceptance versus the neutral, practice-oriented acceptance?
The best way to know is to sit with it. You can't figure it out, because the figuring out part is the part that gets all tangled up in it. And you can say in your intellect that, oh, I'm going to be objective and neutral and everything is fine, and you'll still be growling inside somewhere. In my experience, in my life, sitting with it, all those thoughts that I have about whatever it is, all my ideas about it, trying to figure it out, all the feelings that I have for and against it, eventually fall away, and I begin to see more clearly what this actual situation is. It's not always easy. I mean, sometimes the actual situation is painful. But it's better to see the painfulness of it in its full glory, you could say, and not be owned by it. it's not personal. The things that happen to us aren't personal. No? So it, once we get that, well, if you, as I say, if you sit with it, you'll see that all the ideas that you have about it fall away, because it's just all ideas. And then the truth of it will show itself, and your connection with it, how you're integrated into everything that's happening.
Just to add a kind of a personal element to your answer reflected back on the questioner, I found that if one continues one's practice, regardless of whether you're in a good place, quote, or a bad place, quote,
yes,
that continuity, so the practice or the big you is there in all those realms, in all, yes, those stages, then that, I like, for example, someone might try to say, I'm going to practice my way out of this problem.
Yeah.
That's clearly not the practice.
No.
So, or I'm going to delight in this by practicing. That's also, in my opinion, not the practice. But you sit, nonetheless, in all the situations without any impression,
yeah,
in your head or about what that is.
Yes.
You sit, and then you see the big self is with every situation, and you just continue that.
Yes, which is taking refuge. So you sit and take refuge in the big picture, you could say, in the whole of it, in what lives and lives us, and then allow it to be what it is. So it's 8 o'clock.